Okay, number 17. Let people choose their own actions. One step better than offering people things to do is offering people choices of things to do, so that you're not only using their ability to act, you're not only taking advantage of the fact that action diminishes anxiety and diminishes denial as well, you're also using their ability to decide. You're involving their brain as well as their hands and feet. Ideally, then, you should have a menu of actions that you're prepared to offer people. In my judgment, virtually every risk that strikes at the individual level, virtually every risk where individual precaution taking is appropriate, you should offer people alternative levels of precaution depending on how frightened they are. So what you ideally want to say to people is okay, there's an X, there's a Y, there's a Z. At least do X. Even if you think this is silly, even if you think we're overreacting, even if you think this is no big issue, do X anyhow. X is the minimum level of precaution taking that we think is appropriate. Okay, we recommend Y. Y is more protective than X, and we think it's worth the additional protection. We would rather you did Y than X. We think Y is appropriately a stronger precaution. But if you think we're overreacting and you think we're being silly, all right, you know, you can do X and you won't be in trouble. Okay. If you think we're underreacting, if you feel more vulnerable than most people, or you think this is more serious than most people do, you're more worried than most people, and Y doesn't look like enough to you, do Z with our blessings. You know, Z is, we're not calling Z irrational. We don't think Z is crazy. We don't think Z is hysterical. We don't think you're panicking if you do Z. Z is just fine. It's not, you know, it goes a little further than we want to go. We're only recommending Y. But we're recommending Y with brackets around it. Y with X for the people who think we're overreacting and Z for the people who think we're underreacting. And the evidence is if there is an X and a Y and a Z, two benefits happen. One is you get more Y. You get more of the recommended precaution when there are alternatives. The other benefit, which is even more important, is if there's an X and a Z, then people who do X and Z are not being defined as disobedient. They're not outside your system. They haven't said to themselves, I'm a rebel. You know, I don't have much trouble convincing my clients to have an X. It's usually not that hard to get them to suggest something that is a lesser precaution. I have enormous trouble persuading my clients to have Z's. In the SARS outbreak, for example, wearing a mask might have been a Z. In the anthrax attacks, having a Cipro prescription might have been a very appropriate Z. Now, actually starting to take Cipro would not be an appropriate Z, right? I mean, you know, you shouldn't take antibiotics unless you need them. But having the prescription and filling the prescription, having the tablets on hand, is more than the CDC wanted to recommend, but it would have been a very useful Z. I'm talking about this as if it were individual to let people make their own choices, but there's also a policy issue here. You can allow people to advise you on what the policy ought to be. And that's also part of letting people choose their own actions, of making people active decision makers rather than passive victims. On one level, on the individual level, you get people active rather than passive by offering them a menu of things to do and letting them choose. On the policy level, you make people active rather than passive by dilemma sharing and by saying, oh, well, we might do this, we might do this, we might do this, where we is we the agency, we the company, and you get their counsel, you get their input, you get their involvement. Now, almost everybody does some kind of public involvement. Certainly almost every government agency is obliged to do public involvement. I'm offering you a different frame on public involvement. I'm not thinking of public involvement as sort of punching a legal ticket, meeting your legal obligation to have asked the public what you ought to do before you go and do what you were going to do anyhow. I'm suggesting something fairly different, which is if you're worried about people being excessively alarmed, if you're worried about panic, if you're worried about denial, if you're worried about people having trouble tolerating their fear, getting them involved in policymaking is a very good way to reduce those concerns. Okay, next one is Jody's.
Number 18 relates to number 16 and 17, and I'll try to pull it together. Number 18 is ask more of people. In a crisis, pro-social, resilient impulses vie for dominance with our less desirable impulses, panic, passivity, and selfishness. You can ally with the resilient impulses against the others by asking more of people. Asking more of people means you have to rely on their wisdom more and your own wisdom less. This is sometimes hard for officials and experts to do. It is tempting to keep the public subservient and compliant instead. In an emergency, people immediately become ambivalent about just their overall reaction to the emergency. Am I going to rise to the occasion? Am I going to fall apart? We all feel that way. The experts feel that way, officials and the public. Am I going to cope with this, or am I going to be a basket case? It's my strong belief that the experts can help drive the response to the higher functioning levels that we're all capable of, that most of us are capable of, by aligning with our resilience, by asking more of us, by doing the other things that Peter was recommended of offering us things to do, by being ready for our desire to help, being ready for us to volunteer. This, again, is that choice point for experts and officials. They usually don't recognize this as a choice. They automatically become over-reassuring and ally with our tendency to regress. The dilemma here that faces experts when they're thinking about whether to ask more of people or not is between expert decision-making and democracy and individual and community control. Deciding and doing everything yourself disempowers the public. It's a kind of infantilization. It's insulting and it's demoralizing. If you ask more of people, they will generally rise to the occasion. They'll handle the emergency better, recover more quickly, feel better about themselves, and feel better about you. In Los Angeles, the Community Emergency Response Team, which is called CERT, and probably some of you know about this because it's very much overlaps occupational health and safety. CERT helps citizens prepare for emergency and disaster situations where they may initially be on their own, where public responders can't get to them, like earthquakes, and the individual's actions can make a real difference. The CERT website has question and answers like, how many drops of what kind of bleach to use to maintain your stored water that everybody's supposed to have down in their basement? Where to get the right kind of goggles and dust masks? How to check your gas shutoff valve? Page after page of very useful information in a crisis. Over 40 states and 6 countries are now using CERT training materials. CERT calls this their positive and realistic approach. It's hopeful, it's heartening, and it's a model for people who want to be part of disaster preparedness. And nor does self-reliance have to mean every household for itself. There are amazing examples of very local community organizing that energizes communities, stiffens the spines of the fearful, lifts the spirits of the numb, activates the stunned, and actually takes care of the neighborhood during a disaster. I want to tell you the story about Diane Lapson, who was the tenants, who led a tenants association in Independence Plaza, which was an apartment complex right near Ground Zero in New York. She led her tenants organization in making sure that elderly residents had medicine. They cooked food for rescue workers and housebound tenants. They set up a crisis drop-in center because they discovered that one of the people who lived in the building was a social worker. And they even obtained pet food for stranded dogs and cats. Peter and I attended a bioterrorism conference at Johns Hopkins last February, and when it was full of all sorts of experts, like the mayor of Oklahoma City and the health commissioner from New York who had managed the anthrax crisis, and the largest applause of the entire day was for Diane Lapson after she talked about her community organizing. Perhaps the toughest dilemma the United States government has faced with respect to the threat of terrorism is what to ask us to do. You remember the derision that followed the duct tape communications. I think that response was pretty unfair, and I think that it revealed more about the public's state of denial and feelings of helplessness than about the Department of Homeland Security's trivialization of the risk, which I do not think they were trivializing the risk. Their list of things to do was actually pretty good, and even duct tape isn't a foolish thing to have around in a terrorist attack. I think it is true that the government has asked too little of the public since 9/11. Sometimes it seems that all we're being asked to do is go shopping and keep going to the malls, and if we stop shopping so much, the terrorists will have won. When another attack comes, as it must, a non-involved public will be less prepared emotionally, less prepared logistically than we could have been. Getting us involved in preparedness activities and expecting us to be able to sustain our involvement means helping us bear our anxiety about terrorism instead of helping us bury it. Peter?
Okay. Jody, before you disappear, are there questions for either of us about that or anything else? Yes.
The duct tape example has been used a couple times, and as you indicated, duct tape can be helpful, for example, in a chemical release. Can you say more about where that went wrong, that advice? It seems to follow some of what you're saying, giving people some things to do. Obviously, it went wrong, and maybe you could help us figure out why that is.
One thing that I think went wrong with that was it kept company with a kind of patronizing, get out of our way, everything will be all right message. They'd been patronizing us for a good deal of the time, and suddenly they asked us to do something that sounded mildly silly on the face of it, like, you know, close up your house in plastic sheeting with duct tape, and we were taken aback.
Some of you are familiar with the ready.gov website, which is the Department of Homeland Security website, that is an effort to involve people, to enlist people's ability to help. It's not as bad as it might be. It's not terrific yet, but it's getting better. And the national government is not used to asking people to do much of anything except pay their taxes and shop. And it's new. It doesn't come easily. It doesn't come naturally to them. But, you know, among the long list of lessons that we're trying to get across today, that's one they seem to have taken seriously. And it's sort of sad that their first effort to ask more of people fell afoul of people's denial. Okay, number 19 is acknowledge errors, deficiencies, and misbehaviors. I routinely advise my clients, corporate clients and government clients, to acknowledge anything negative about their own performance that the audience already knows or that critics know and the audience is eventually going to find out. In fact, I don't just advise them to acknowledge it, I advise them to wallow in it. It's harder to figure out what to do with things that reflect badly on your organization that are secret. I mean, if there's actually something that nobody knows and nobody is likely to find out unless you tell them and it makes you look bad, then you have to be some kind of saint to tell them. I don't have too many saints among my clients. I think that's fairly rare behavior. If nobody knows and they're likely to find out, on the other hand, then blowing the whistle on yourself is a fairly rational thing to do on the grounds that when you blow the whistle on yourself, it does very much less harm than when someone else blows the whistle on you. But the strongest case is to reveal things about yourself that people already know. Well, you're not really revealing it. You're just admitting that you're aware of it and that you're willing to talk about it. After the Exxon Valdez spill, you know, most Americans were very preoccupied with Valdez. They thought very negative things about Exxon. And it was in that context that Exxon developed its exhibit at Epcot. Its environmental exhibit at Epcot. And I went to the Exxon exhibit at Epcot, which was a superb environmental exhibit, except it said absolutely nothing about Valdez. Nothing. Now, it may now. I have no idea what they've done in recent years. But a couple of years after the accident, there was nothing on Valdez in that environmental exhibit. There's nothing they could have said about Valdez that would have been as harmful to Exxon's reputation as saying nothing about Valdez. Valdez was not a secret. You know, we all knew about it. We just weren't sure Exxon had noticed. So it is indeed important to wallow in things that reflect negatively on you. It is no less important to do that in a crisis than it is in non-crisis situations. It is, however, easier to do that in a crisis than in non-crisis situations, because in a crisis, people don't really want to hear bad things about you. You know, we're in a crisis. We're relying on you to protect us. We're relying on you to save our bacon. And the last thing we want to do is lose faith in you now. In fact, among people who study crises, one of the operational definitions of the end of the crisis is when the recriminations begin. Because people do not want to do a lot of blame game until after the crisis is over. While they are at risk, they don't want to blame anybody, and they particularly don't want to blame the people they are relying on to protect them. What that means is it's an ideal time for you to talk about the things you screwed up.
Quick question. It doesn't seem to me that Toronto handled that SARS, you know, the incident very well. Have they started to acknowledge some of these problems yet?
You're absolutely right about the implications of what I'm saying. They should. My impression is twofold. They haven't acknowledged that they did a bad job. They haven't apologized for doing a bad job. However, their media have covered that they did a bad job. They had a government commission which reported that they did a bad job and quoted Jody and me at length, so it has to be a good report, that they did a bad job. And in response to the commission, they have hired, I don't know who yet, I don't think the contract's been awarded yet, but they put out an RFP for a communication expert to review the job they did and tell them the lessons learned. So they have not yet owned up to it, but they do seem to be getting ready to own up to it. Okay, I want to give you one other example before we go on. During the anthrax attacks of 2001, there was one very significant mistake that the CDC made, technical mistake that the CDC made. The CDC believed and said very confidently that as long as a letter was sealed, okay, the anthrax spores inside the letter couldn't get out. And a sealed letter was safe. Okay? And they were very confident that was true, and they asserted confidently that it was true, and they turned out wrong. Arguably they should have known better. I mean, maybe if they'd worked in a mailroom during summer vacation and realized the way sorting equipment whacks, the hell out of mail, they would have realized it. Maybe if they were engineers instead of health people, they would have realized that paper isn't actually a solid. There's a variety of ways they might have known. On the other hand, things go wrong. You make mistakes. Sometimes you don't know stuff, and they didn't know this. By the time they discovered it, two postal workers were dying, and two huge postal facilities were contaminated. And it was a very significant error. Okay. They were extremely reluctant for weeks. Extremely reluctant to apologize, extremely reluctant even to acknowledge that they had made this error. It's not that they didn't feel bad. I was working with people in CDC. They felt terrible, but it was interfering with their sleep. But they didn't want to say so, and in their mind, it had to do with being professional. Okay? What was vivid is as soon as they started acknowledging it, as soon as they started saying, "God, we wish we'd gotten that right," Boy, if we could do this again, the one thing we would change is we would realize that this finely milled anthrax spores aerosolize much more easily than anything we've ever seen as physicians, and we could have saved some lives we lost. And the minute they started saying things like that, the postal workers calmed down, the unions calmed down. And a whole bunch of publics that were extremely angry at the CDC got much calmer when the CDC was able to acknowledge its mistake. Okay, number 20. Apologize often for your errors, deficiencies, and misbehaviors. It's not enough to tell us what you did wrong. You have to tell us what you did wrong with your head hanging low. So we know, it was something you did wrong, not something you did right. Now, the seesaw operates here. The seesaw operates in so many areas, but certainly one of the most important seesaws in risk communication is the seesaw of blame. And to make this vivid to you, I want to give you a home example before I give you a professional example. I want you to assume that your child has been caught hitting another kid in school. And teacher caught him, teacher sent him to the principal's office, and as part of his punishment now, he's got to tell you what happened. And I want you to look at two different scenarios. In the first scenario, your child says, "Mom, Dad, I really messed up in school today." "Well, what happened?" you say. "Well, I hit Johnny, and the teacher had to send me to the principal's office." "Well, why'd you hit Johnny?" "Well, I mean, that's not the point. He called me a dirty name, and I lost my temper, and I hit him. But it's my fault. I shouldn't have lost my temper. I shouldn't have hit him." Now, at this point, you are secretly proud of your child for hitting Johnny. Okay? You're also glad that the teacher caught him and punished him, but no additional punishment is necessary at home. Your kid is aware of what he did wrong. Okay? Now, scenario two. You won't believe what that idiot teacher did to me today. Johnny called me a dirty name, so of course I decked him, and the teacher had the nerve to send me to the principal's office. Now what's your attitude? Okay. Your kid's got an attitude problem, doesn't he? And he's going to get an attitude adjustment at home on top of the one he already got at school. Now, what I want you to notice is it's the same data. Okay. In both cases, your child is telling you the same information. You know, Johnny called him a dirty name. He hit Johnny. Teacher caught him and punished him. Okay. If your child is attentive to the way in which it was his fault, you're attentive to the way in which he defended his honor. If he's attentive to the way in which he defended his honor, you're attentive to the way in which it's his fault. One of you is going to blame him. One of you is going to forgive him. And he gets to decide which seat on the seesaw to sit on and which seat on the seesaw to leave for you. That's not just because you're parents and he's a child. That's how we behave toward corporations and government agencies that make mistakes. When they are apologetic, when they are sorry, when they are regretful, we forgive them much more readily. When they say it's not really their mistake, we don't forgive them nearly as much. To give you a real example, to go with a hypothetical example, look at the 1993 food poisoning outbreak. It's E. coli 0157H7, for those of you who follow these things, at Jack in the Box restaurants, mostly on the west coast of the U.S., in Washington State and elsewhere. Two things went wrong during those, and it was a very serious outbreak. I mean, a couple of kids died, and hundreds were hospitalized, some of them with serious permanent health problems. So a very serious outbreak. And two things went wrong. One thing that went wrong is the supplier delivered to Jack in the Box hamburger that was contaminated with high levels of this particularly virulent strain of E. coli. The other thing that went wrong is Jack in the Box didn't cook the hamburger hot enough to kill the E. coli. If it hadn't been contaminated, it wouldn't matter that it was half raw. If it hadn't been half raw, it wouldn't have mattered that it was contaminated. It took two mistakes to kill some children and hurt some others. Okay? Everybody understand the situation? Okay. Jack in the Box put out communications in which it said, essentially, we're the victim here. You know, the supplier delivered us hamburger meat that's unsafe to eat, that's unfit to eat. It says right here in our contract, they have to deliver us meat that's fit to eat, and we're going to sue them. And they did indeed sue them. The supplier put out communications saying, we feel terrible that we delivered to Jack in the Box meat that was contaminated with E. coli 0157H7. We had no idea that this incredibly virulent strain of E. coli required a change in our testing procedures. Okay? You get the picture. Jack in the Box blamed the supplier. The supplier blamed the supplier. The public blamed Jack in the Box. Okay. So this is true of food recalls, it's true of industrial accidents, it's true of epidemics, it's true of anything where there is blame to be allocated. The more of it you take, the less of it you get. Sometimes there's no seesaw, it's just flat out your fault. And then we're in a different dynamic where it all has to do with forgiveness. But the same rules apply. We forgive people when they take the blame. We forgive people when they say they're sorry. We forgive people. No, that's not all you have to do. You also have to improve. You have to compensate the people you harm. There are a variety of things you have to do in order to be forgiven. But it all starts with acknowledging what you did, which is 19. Acknowledging what you did. No hypothetical acknowledgments count. Whatever it is I might have done that made people upset, I'm sorry. That's what politicians like to do. No credit. If you don't know what you did that made people upset, you're not apologizing. So you need to acknowledge what you did with, you know, chapter and verse, and then you need to say you're sorry. Okay, number 21. Be explicit about anchoring frames. Okay. You remember in the introduction several hours ago, I talked about the mental models work And the importance in crisis communication of realizing that the audiences already have opinions, they already have values, they're not blank slates. And the work of the Carnegie Mellon people in particular on mental models is a way of studying the what's going on for your audience before you start talking, so that you're addressing that directly rather than ignoring it and pretending that they're a blank slate. Once you recognize that people are not blank slates, then obviously the key question, and the question that anchoring frames as an issue raises, is how do you connect to people's existing values and opinions and emotions and, you know, all the material that they bring to the interaction? Now, ideally, the connection is to find ways that predispose them to agree with you. So if you want to persuade them of something, you find values and emotions that already pre-exist in your audience that make them want to be on your side. But very often you can't do that. Very often there isn't much that predisposes your audience toward what you want them to do. Or even if there is, there's also a lot of stuff that predisposes your audience against what you want them to do. And you have the question that's come up several times in the course of the day: do you ignore the things that make your audience want to go the other way, or do you address it directly? And the key lesson in being explicit about anchoring frames is the importance of addressing it directly. What you want to do is take your audience from where it is to where you want it to be. Okay? So you need to say, you believe X. Lots of people believe X. It makes sense to believe X. I used to believe X before I got hired by this agency and started studying the issue. Turns out, surprisingly, X isn't true. I know that's hard for you to believe. It was hard for me to believe. It turns out Y is true, and here's some of the evidence that Y is true. And you are explicitly telling people you're trying to change their minds. Now, that's not as strong as not having to change their minds. But it's much stronger than having to change their minds and pretending you don't. You can't, if you've got a room full of people who believe X and you're trying to convince them of Y, you can't just walk into the room and say, why. Comment.
When you're getting a wide variety of beliefs and you're not sure what the major belief is or how what you need to discern to address the major belief, you need to know where they're coming from to start with. How do you find out what the majority belief is?
Well, that's why God made survey research. If you don't know, and very often you don't know, then you need studies to find out. And again, in my judgment, the mental models approach, which is the Carnegie Mellon approach, is the best approach for guiding that kind of research. Now, that said, often you just don't have time, or you just don't have budget, and you have to shoot from the hip. Shooting from the hip is a lot worse than studying the question. But it's a lot better than not even asking yourself the question. So if you can't study the answer, at least guess at the answer. At least sit there at your desk and say to yourself, I wonder what these people think already. And come up with some hypotheses. Check them with your secretary, your husband, and the janitor down in the basement to see if they ring true to them. And if you haven't got time for more than that, go with that.
Let me add another possibility. Sometimes, when you don't have a lot of time, you just ask the people. So you're trying to convince all these people not to wear masks. Nobody ever said to the people, why do you want to wear masks? And so I decided to do that. And I asked some people in Singapore why they wanted to wear masks, and in Toronto why they wanted to wear masks. And they said, well, they're telling me that, you know, you can get this thing by coughing and sneezing in people's faces, and I ride the crowded subway every day, and they're also telling us to cover our mouths when we sneeze, and to wash our hands after we sneeze, and that's all the recommendations are giving us. But when I'm in the crowded subway and I'm holding onto my briefcase with one hand, I'm hanging onto the pole with the other, and I sneeze, you know, I can't wash my hands, and I can't really even cover my mouth most of the time, and I stick my hand back on the subway pole, and, you know, somebody else sticks their hands there. And that's what's in my head when I want to wear the mask, is sort of the message that I got. But all the people giving the public the signal, do not wear masks, it's not necessary, I saw no evidence whatsoever that any of those people asked the public, why do you want to wear the mask?
Best answer, study it. Second best answer, ask them. Third best answer, guess. Worst answer, don't even wonder. endless examples. I mean, one of my clients for some time has been the biosolids industry. Biosolids are, you know, what the rest of us think of as sewage sludge. And in our heart of hearts, we have yet another name for it. But we'll keep this a family tape. The essence of the biosolids industry is to try and put this stuff as a fertilizer in agricultural lands. And everybody has the same automatic reaction. You're going to take human excrement and grow food in it? My mother told me not to touch my excrement. You know, I learned that when I was 2, and it has stood me in good stead ever since, and suddenly you're going back on it. Well, there is a scientific answer to that question. You cannot make progress on the scientific answer to that question until you start out by acknowledging that people get the willies when you talk about growing their food in their own excrement. And that, you know, the same thing applies to mad cow disease. You know, the idea of cows that are downers, that are sick, that can't hobble to the slaughterhouse, you know, that have been made to drink cow blood in our food supply, that's daunting. You want to convince people it's safe? Okay, convince them it's safe. You can't convince them it's safe without first acknowledging that it's disgusting. Okay. So all of those, it seems to me, are examples of taking the anchoring frame seriously. And Jody's example of why people want to wear masks. And you know, maybe you can come up with an answer and you can explain that's why you want to wear masks and you're wrong. Maybe you can come up with an answer and you wind up saying, son of a gun, now that I understand why you want to wear masks, you're right, go ahead and wear masks. But, you know, assuming you're going to try and convince them that you're right and they're wrong, you haven't got a prayer unless you start with their opinion and the reasons for their opinion. Okay, number 22, be explicit about changes in official opinion, prediction, or policy. This is just an example of 21. One of the ways that organizations run afoul of anchoring frames, and government organizations in particular run afoul of anchoring frames, is they want to change their mind without saying they changed their mind. Whatever is going on, if it's embarrassing, it feels better to the official to sneak in the new opinion, the new policy, without ever acknowledging that it deviates from the old. So what you get more often than not is every time a policy changes, it is described as if it were not a change. That works just fine for the people who weren't paying attention. They didn't know about the old policy anyhow. But for the people who were paying attention, it looks somewhere between incoherent and dishonest. And it can backfire very badly. The most stunning example for me is mad cow disease. In late 2003 and early 2004, the USDA, over a period of days, went from we are taking every conceivable precaution to we have a whole bunch of new precautions. And at no point did they explain that change. It was like the people who heard them say we have these new precautions weren't supposed to remember that 36 hours ago they had said about the old precautions that they consisted of every conceivable precaution. And again, for those people who weren't paying any attention, they didn't notice. For people who were paying attention, it looked at least irrational. Okay, and probably dishonest. Okay, so as an absolute, to me, an obvious example of anchoring frames. When you change your mind, the anchoring frame is what you used to think, and you start with what you used to think, and you explain why you changed your mind. Which, of course, will be much easier if, when you were explaining what you used to think, you said, "This is tentative. This is uncertain. We're going to be learning things in the weeks ahead that may make us change our mind." So the appropriate 1-2 punch, early on admit you're uncertain, later on admit you changed your mind. You know, the bad way, early on pretend you're certain, later on pretend you're certain again about something completely different and ignore the transition. Okay. Jody has one more example of this in action that I want you to hear, and then we'll go on to the last 3 points and we'll be done. Jody?
This is my last example, and it's also my last example about masks. The need to acknowledge changes is a very hard lesson to remember. During the 2003 SARS outbreaks, the US CDC did not recommend face masks, except in very serious hospital settings. But they did not recommend face masks, even in outpatient settings, even in emergency rooms, except when there was an extremely persuasive reason to suspect SARS. But in September of 2003, with the flu season coming, the CDC changed its recommendation and said that patients with respiratory symptoms should be immediately given surgical masks upon entering hospitals or doctors' offices. The CDC announced this new recommendation during a four-hour nationwide satellite broadcast on SARS and flu that was aimed at healthcare workers and public health officials. CDC epidemiologist Linda Chiarello's comments were accompanied by pictures of adorable Taiwanese children in hand-decorated surgical masks, those flimsy kinds of masks. I was watching the broadcast in a New Jersey television studio. When the pictures of the masks came on, a public health nurse in the audience burst out, "Those masks are not going to work." And we talked to her afterwards about that, and she said, after all, during SARS-1, we all heard over and over again that surgical masks were not useful and weren't necessary. And if masks were needed, they had to be N95 respirator masks, not flimsy surgical masks. Nothing in the CDC broadcast acknowledged that their recommendation had changed or why.
Okay, number 23. Don't lie and don't tell half-truths. I should be able to skip immediately to number 24. I mean, I started the day by saying these are all counterintuitive. I assume this one is not counterintuitive. Most of us actually do realize that lying and telling half-truths does harm. Lying isn't the main problem. Most of my clients don't lie. That's, in fact, why it takes so many PR people to draft their statements, because they're working extremely hard to mislead without lying, and that takes a lot of effort. They don't lie. What they do, and this is true whether they work for government agencies or corporations or activist groups, what most of my clients do is frame the truth or frame a half-truth in a way that favors their side or what they imagine to be their side. For me, the classic example came out of Three Mile Island. During the Three Mile Island accident, Metropolitan Medicine, the utility involved, put out a news release in which it said, the plant is cooling according to design. I later served on the Kemeny Commission, the government commission that investigated the accident at Three Mile Island. So I had a chance to ask the author of that statement, how could you possibly say the plant is cooling according to design? This was going wrong, that was going wrong, that was going wrong. All those things were not supposed to be happening, and they were happening. How could you possibly write that the plant is cooling according to design? And he looked at me and he said, well, you know, that's the thing about nuclear power plants. They're designed to cool even when many, many things go wrong. So yes, many, many things went wrong, but it was still cooling according to design. Now, a more recent example of the same half-truth, it seems to me, has to do with what the meaning of is. And there are endless examples, and I don't want to add example to example to example. The point that I do want to make sure people understand is that while lying is rare, that kind of distortion is extraordinarily common. Okay. I'm hoping that those of you who are listening understand that it is common in your organization too. We have a tendency to imagine that this is something other people do and we don't. And what happens, it seems to me, is, you know, when our enemy, when our opponent, when our critics distort, they let facts go. They leave out some facts. They carefully shape other facts in order to lead to an impression that we think is inaccurate. We therefore feel like they are misleading the public, and that seems extraordinarily unethical. When we distort, on the other hand, we are also leaving out facts. We are also carefully framing facts, but we're doing it in order to help the public see the truth, with a capital T. And that doesn't seem nearly as unethical. Now, it looks the same way to them, only in reverse. Now, I'm not an ethicist. I'm not saying don't do that because it's unethical. What I'm saying is don't do that because it backfires, and it particularly backfires in a crisis. In a routine event, you may get away with those distortions. People aren't paying that much attention. But one of the defining characteristics of a crisis is people are paying a lot of attention. So you need ethics not to distort routine news. It shouldn't require ethics not to distort crisis news. Intelligence should be sufficient because those distortions will come out. And again, the examples are Legion, Secretary of Agriculture, and Veneman, to the best of my knowledge, did not lie. Okay. What she did is allow lots of misimpressions to survive, including the misimpression that the discovery of the United States' only mad cow so far was a result of very assiduous, extensive testing. That mad cow got tested for BSE, not because anybody suspected BSE, but because she had been through a bad pregnancy. And they suspected other kinds of illnesses and therefore scheduled her automatically for a battery of tests, which included BSE tests. The point being that we found the BSE by luck. Okay, we didn't suspect BSE. Now, it could be that the only mad cow ever to be in the United States was found by luck. It's likelier that we have some, not a whole lot. If we had a whole lot, we'd find more. But we have some, not enough to represent an epidemic, not enough to represent a serious health risk, but more than one. Okay? Ann Veneman never said there is only one mad cow in the United States. Ann Veneman never said we intentionally tested that animal for BSE because it was showing symptoms of BSE, but she allowed us to think those things. Okay? Now, the people who were paying good attention figured out better. People who weren't paying good attention got misimpressions. So far, it's worked fine for her. The misimpressions have worked fine for her. What's going to happen to those misimpressions when the second mad cow turns up? Okay, you know, I mean, she is underestimating the later cost of having misled people. And again, she didn't lie. You know, but she was a whole lot less honest than I believe she thinks she was. And she was a whole lot less honest than I believe she ought to have been. And she was absolutely typical. Okay? This is not a bad example. It's only a typical example. Okay, number 24. Aim for total candor and transparency. You will notice this is the only time in the 25 recommendations that I don't tell you what to do, I just tell you what to aim for. Okay? Because you know, even I don't think you can achieve total candor and transparency. Even I actually don't think you ought to achieve total candor and transparency. There are doubtless things in a crisis the public genuinely shouldn't know. And there are all kinds of reasons for falling short of total candor and transparency. Candor will give the terrorists information they can use to hurt us. Candor will make it harder to catch the terrorists. Candor will damage our reputation, and our reputation isn't just about our reputation. We need our reputation because we're in a crisis and we need people to do what we recommend, and our reputation is important to saving people's lives right now. All of those arguments and others that I haven't bothered to mention make sense. They make sense. There really are some reasons not to tell the whole truth. I am not worried that you and your organizations will neglect to notice those reasons. I am worried that you will have recourse to them too often. Okay. So, I mean, if you want a concrete piece of advice to aim toward total candor and transparency, here it is. Keep a list, a written list, of every time you say something that's not quite true, or you decide not to say something that is true. Okay. Every time you're in a meeting and somebody says, let's get rid of that sentence, or let's add this sentence. And it's clear that there is a candor issue. It's clear in your internal discussions that you're moving away from candor, but for a good reason. Write it down. and write down the reason. Okay. Now, I have to tell you, I've never had a client take this advice. Okay. But if you take this advice, two good things will happen. One is you'll stop misleading yourself that that's rare. You'll begin to realize you are filling books with the things you decided to say or the things you decided not to say in spite of a high standard of candor. Okay? You'll realize you're violating your high standard of candor very, very frequently. The other thing that'll happen is you'll begin to imagine that list on the front page of the New York Times. And that's very healthy because if in the reason column you write something that'll look pretty good on the front page of the New York Times, then you're probably right to do it the way you're doing it. If that reason is going to look awfully weak on the front page of the New York Times, consider the possibility that it is awfully weak. Okay, and finally, number 25, be careful with risk comparisons. And I put this one last because it enables me to go back to where I started. You will remember that I started this presentation by talking about the distinction between hazard and outrage. Hazard is what technical people mean by risk. It's usually the magnitude of the risk multiplied by its probability. Outrage is what non-technical people, what normal people mean by risk. And it's a function of things like control and voluntariness and memorability and trust. And I argued at the very beginning of the day that outrage and hazard are quite different. They're both part of risk, but they have very little to do with each other. And in particular, they have a very low correlation with each other. The public is much more interested in outrage than in hazard. The experts are much more interested in hazard than in outrage. And that explains why risk comparisons screw up. Okay? Here it is in a nutshell. When you do a risk comparison, you are doing, in my language, a hazard comparison. The public will hear it, in my language, as an outrage comparison. So when you say that an anthrax attack is a smaller risk than driving your car to a meeting about the anthrax attack, what you mean to be saying is the technical risk, the magnitude times the probability of people getting hurt by anthrax is lower than the magnitude times the probability of their getting hurt in a traffic accident on their way to the meeting. But they won't be heard. You won't be heard that way. You'll be heard as saying driving is a bigger outrage than getting contaminated with anthrax by a terrorist. Because you're talking hazard, the audience is listening outrage. And when you compare a high hazard, low outrage risk to a high outrage, low hazard risk, and you're comparing the hazard, and we imagine you're comparing the outrage, from our point of view, it feels like you're lying. Now, the only way you can make it work is by talking about it explicitly. I mean, if you want to say to people, look, there are two ways of looking at this problem. One is it really likely to kill you? And the other is it really terrifying and infuriating? And in terms of is it really likely to kill you, this one is worse than this one. And in terms of is it really terrifying and infuriating, this one is worse than this one. You do all of that, and people can get it. You know, as long as you're not pulling rank, as long as you're not saying, you know, now that you know that it's not a serious risk, you've got no right to worry about it. If you say, of course people are worried about it, of course people are right to be worried about it. Nobody wants to take another wonderful example. Do you remember the Washington D.C. sniper? The very, very few people got killed. Only a handful of people got killed. More people died on D.C. roads during the period the sniper was shooting people on D.C. roads from other causes than from the sniper. You know, can you imagine the sniper's defense? You know, well, you know, all that money spent catching me and trying me and incarcerating me, you'd save more lives if you let me snipe once in a while and painted lines down the center of the highway. It's not a successful defense, okay? And it's not a successful defense because we care about outrage, and the only way you can help us distinguish outrage from hazard in your risk comparisons is by doing both risk comparisons, by saying, in hazard terms, this is the baddie. In outrage terms, this is the baddie, and those are both reasonable ways to think about the risk. And you do all of that, and you are enlightening people rather than cornering them. Commentators expressing their contempt for the media's and the public's attention to SARS used all kinds of risk comparisons, from lightning to falling down the stairs. But their favorite risk comparison was, of course, the flu. And endless people made the point that SARS is less dangerous than the flu, that more people die even in an average flu season than had died of SARS. That's true. Okay? But SARS is, in a variety of ways, a much bigger source of outrage than the flu. It's much more highly dreaded. It's new and unfamiliar. You could run through a list of outrage components and get a very clear sense of why people appropriately saw SARS as a big deal, even people who routinely shrug off the flu. Okay. Furthermore, I mean, there are a variety of things that are important. SARS was new. That's not just an outrage thing. It's also a hazard thing. There's no natural resistance to SARS, as far as the experts could tell. There was no vaccine. The possible pandemic could have been huge. It had that in common with avian flu more recently. SARS was already showing some frightening aspects. There were super spreaders. Who were far more infectious than other people. It was turning out unexpectedly difficult to prevent additional infections in hospital settings. Routine anti-infection precautions were turning out not to work. Because of hospital disruptions, some cities had already become unsafe places to be sick in. All kinds of routine surgeries and routine psychiatric treatments and routine medical treatments had been canceled. In cities because the hospital was a dangerous place to go. And, of course, thousands of people were already under quarantine. People are not normally, in a normal flu season, people are not quarantined because someone they know has flu. Okay? We quarantined thousands of people because someone they knew had SARS. Okay? Or even someone they knew was suspected of possibly having SARS. Now, there's debate now, a year later, about whether those quarantines were health effective or not, whether that turns out to have been wise or unwise. We didn't know at the time. What we knew is we had something very new, very scary, potentially very dangerous, and it was, in the way that public health always works, it was important to take sufficient precautions, even if that took, even if that required taking excessive precautions, because we weren't sure yet which precautions would be sufficient. What I want to, the point I want to make, and the point I want to end with, this is a very nice time to make it. As we wait right now in February of 2004, as we wait to see if avian flu becomes the big one, the flu pandemic that's bound to hit eventually, and when it does, bound to kill millions of people, it's worth noting that most of the experts who criticize the public for overreacting to SARS compared to flu, okay, they didn't do much about flu. Okay? During and in the early fall of 2003, before the start of the 2003-2004 flu season, SARS was gone. All the people who, during the SARS scare, were saying, poo-poo, SARS is no big deal, we ought to be worried about flu, during the flu season, were nowhere to be seen. These were not people who wanted us to worry about flu. These were people who wanted us not to worry, period. I want to end with one very important point, and it's a point I started with. These 25 recommendations are the unaccustomed side of a bunch of dilemmas. Okay? I am not saying you should do it all the way I recommend. I am not saying it's impossible to go too far my way. It is possible to go too far my way. It is possible to be too candid, to be too alarming, to be too uncertain, to be too personal. All the major points I've made, you could do them too much, but you won't. Nobody ever does. Nobody does them consistently enough. So my advice to you and my advice to the organizations you work with is work on planning to get as far in these directions as you can. You have my personal guarantee you won't go too far. Too far exists, but you won't get there. Thank you.